This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Once a Runner, a novel by John L. Parker, Jr., narrated by Patrick Lawler. This book is for Jack Batchelor and Frank Shorter, old friends, great runners, in fond remembrance fellows of many trials and many miles. How did I know you ran the mile in 4:30 in high school? That's easy. Everyone ran the mile in 4:30 in high school. Frank Shorter, out running somewhere, circa 1969. Once a Runner. One. Once. The night joggers were out as usual. The young man could see dim figures on the track, even in this pale light, slowly pounding round and round the most infinite of footpaths. There would be, he knew, plump, determined-looking women, slogging along while fleshy knees quivered. They would occasionally brush damp hair fiercely from their eyes and dream of certain cruel and smiling MCs, bikinis, ribbon cuttings, and the like. And then, of course, tennis with white-toothed males, wild tangos in the moonlight. And men, too, of various ages and levels of dilapidation, perhaps also grinding out secret fantasies. Did they picture themselves a Peter Snell held back only by fat or fear as they turned their 90-second quarters? The young man stood outside the fence for a few moments while moths attacked the streetlight dustily, leaving him in a dim spotlight of swirling shadows. He loved early fall in Florida's panhandle. Leaves would be turning elsewhere, but here the hot breath of summer held forth. In the moist warmth there was a slight edge, though, a faint promise of cooler air hanging in the treetops and close to the Spanish moss. He picked up his small travel bag and went in the gate, walking clockwise on the track toward the white starting post at the head of the first turn. The joggers ignored the stranger in street clothes, and he likewise paid them no attention. They would always be there. The high jump pit had been rearranged, a new section of bleachers added, a water jump installed for the steeplechase. But mostly it looked the same as it did 4 years ago. The same as a 440-yard oval probably will always look to one who knows a quarter of a mile by the inches. The games were over for this time around. He knew quite well that for him they were over for good. 4 years is a very long time in some circles. In actual time, real-world time, as that of shopkeepers, insurance sellers, compounders of interest, and so on, it is perhaps not long at all. But in his own mind, time reposed in peculiar receptacles. To him, the passing of 1 minute took on all manner of rare meaning. A minute was 1/4 of a 4-minute mile, a coffee spoon of his days and ways. As with many of the others, he had no idea what he would be doing now that it was all over. It was such a demanding thing, so final, so cathartic, that most of them simply never thought beyond it. They were scattered around the world now, he supposed, doing pretty much what he was doing at this moment, thinking everything over, tallying gains and losses. He was going to have to pick up the thread of a normal life again, and although he did not exactly know why, he had to start by coming back here, back to the greenhouse warmth of the panhandle, back to this very quarter-mile oval that still held his long, dried sweat. Back to September, the month of promises. He put his bag down by the pole vault pit, looked up track to make sure no one was coming, and then walked up to the starting line. God, he thought, one more time on the line. In lane one, he stood very still, looking down at his street shoes, joggers now going around him with curious glances, and tried to conjure up the feeling. After a moment, a trace of it came to him, and he knew that was all there would be. You can remember it, he told himself, but you cannot experience it again like this. you have to be satisfied with the shadows. Then he thought about how it was in the second and third laps and decided that the shadows were sometimes quite enough. He was 26 years, 5 months, and 2 days old, and though as he stood there on the starting line he felt quite a bit older than that, the muscles that rippled up and down inside his trouser leg could have only been the result, biologically speaking, of more thousands of miles than he cared to think about all at one time. He tried to focus blurred emotions, a metaphysical photographer zeroing in on hard edges to a line in the center square. What was this he was feeling now? Nostalgia? Regret? His mind double-clutched, asked the musical question, "Am I blue?" He could not tell. He realized again how adept he had become at not being able to tell such things. His emotions had calluses, like feet. The starter would tell them to stand tall, so he stood tall for a moment there in the night. There would be the set command, and then the gun. He took a deep breath and began walking into the turn in the familiar counterclockwise direction, the way of all races, and thought, "The first lap is lost in a flash of adrenaline and pounding hooves." 2. Doobie Hall. Doobie Hall was one of those ancient, resonant wooden buildings that seemed to hold the oils and essences of those who had lived there over the years. Like an old cloth easy chair, it was musty but comfortable. As with many structures that had at one time been someone's home, it managed to retain a certain familial warmth amid the current institutional clamor. It thumped and boomed hollowly rather than clicking in the bony staccato manner of more modern, more efficient dwellings. Having once housed Kernsville Mayor Hiram Sidecar Doobie and his various clamoring kindred, the large friendly house had been used during recent years to shelter 30-some members of Southeastern University's Grateful Track Team. Located a merciful 2 blocks from the campus proper, the edifice emitted from morning to night a steady but unpredictable cacophony of barely human yelps, primordial shrieks, and off-key fragments of current hit songs, all courtesy of a singular group of young sapiens whose main function in life was to run, jump, and toss heavy objects about. And to do so far better than, well, ordinary mortals. The net available energy required to produce a 70-foot shot put or a 7-foot high jump just occasionally would not be contained by mere wood and plaster. Walls trembled, and there were eerie goings-on. Old Sidecar Doobie, deceased for years now, would have been tickled pink. His nickname was an artifact of those carefree depression days of yesteryear, when on a Saturday night, for pure diversion, Doobie would down about 3/4 of a jar of the local untaxed beverage, scoop up his tiny, startled wife, a pretty round-eyed thing named Emma Lee, deposit her in the sidecar of his 1932 Harley-Davidson 74-inch flathead, and proceed to more or less terrorize nearby herds of grazing cattle. "Woman," he would tell her, "we fixin' to do some night ridin'." His wild green eyes held her for a moment like a light. "Yee," she said. This is not to imply that Sidecar was an outlaw exactly, since he owned most of the cows in Calhoun County, and a good deal of the land and several sensitive mortgages, for that matter. He was just what some folks called lively. Sidecar was one of those raw, energetic men who understand very early in life which levers and pulleys really worked and which were just for show. And he also understood that the whole shebang was most certainly going to come to a grinding halt one fine day. Irretrievably, he suspected. The only time he found himself in any kind of trouble worthy of the name was one night when he got particularly rowdy, broke down some fences, and, Emma Lee squeaking like a wounded bat, went roaring into downtown Kernsville to "strafe the gall-danged pigeons," while sad-eyed old codgers sat around the courthouse square, watching in wrinkled amusement.
Lord, Sheriff, I Sewanee. I, Lord, don't know why I get so mean sometimes,
he said with true regret the morning after his actual arrest. He held his shaggy, throbbing head in his hands.
Well, Daddy, said the sheriff, people is beginning to talk, and that's a fact.
Sheriff William Boots Doobie was his eldest.
What I can't quite figure out, continued the lawman, is why you always want to go and take Mama with you.
Sidecar perked up suddenly.
Why, he cackled savagely, she enjoys the pure tea hell of it.
It was perhaps reflective of the university town's collective sense of humor when it elected Sidecar mayor a year later. He had run on a platform of throw the bastards out, interesting only because the bastards were, nearly without exception, his own blood kin. True to form, he threw the bastards out. Sidecar's election had been like much of his life, a prize thrust upon him almost without the asking. The old man's one deep hurt came when his youngest boy, born when Sidecar was 52 and Emma Lee nearly 40, turned out to be something of an ordinary klutz. Boots could have had a West Point appointment. Cheryl Ann was a Georgia Tech homecoming queen before dropping out to marry a middle linebacker. It touched a deep, painful place in his breast when Sidecar anxiously watched the youngster, more like a grandson, really, trying to master the elementary gear shift configuration of the big John Deere tractor. When the child was stymied by a cousin half his age at a simple card game, Sidecar wandered out into his fields and wept with rage. At that moment, Sidecar decided, being a man of large concepts as well as a patron of irony, to get for this slightly addled child that which his other children lacked, and didn't want, for that matter, academic status. Years later, this curious task would be accomplished in the way that difficult or impossible objectives are generally accomplished by men of great power and lesser scruples, which is to say, on the sly. He deeded over to Southeastern University, which desperately needed space for a nascent entomology department, the house he had occupied for 7 years as mayor. The deed contained the usual boilerplate, in exchange for $10 and other good and lawful consideration. The nature of the other good and lawful consideration was known only to Sidecar himself, his lawyer, and the president-designate of the school, the Honorable Stephen C. Prigman, late of Florida's august Supreme Court. At that time, Emma Lee was 5 years in her grave, and old Sidecar wanted to get away from down goddamn town politics, and back to his ranch, where he could at least goddamn well die with the honest smell of fresh dung and hay in my nostrils. He didn't mention that he was actually toying with the notion of reviving the ancient and beloved Harley, then rusting under a paint-spattered canvas tarp in the barn. His youngest would have to go through the motions of attending the university, so the formal conferring of the degree would not take place for another 4 years. Sidecar mucked around the ranch, got in his foreman's hair, bought a 55-acre pecan grove, and was finally persuaded to purchase a package tour deal to several Mexican cities of interest. He returned raving about the regenerative properties of certain cactus distillates and hinting darkly about the im and export business. On the scholastic scene, things went without a hitch, and the old man lived to see his boy, dazed and sweating like a field hand in his cap and gown, marching numbly to pomp and circumstance. Entomology outgrew Doobie Hall in a few years, and the track team, delighted to a man, inherited it. Sidecar passed on soon thereafter, but it was said he tried to kick his way out of the coffin on the way to Jesus Walks Among Us Acres. A good bit of Doobie folklore was known in and around Kernsville and accounted for no small amount of graffiti scattered about the campus. Bold red letters on the side of the old field house one semester warned ominously, Sidecar lives. Hiram Sidecar Doobie, lusty gallivanter, bovine terrorist, and ball twister par excellence, ended up as kind of a regional backwoods Kilroy. And the last male heir of his body, he of the dim wit, bogus degree, and unaccountable penchant for hurting insects, his youngest son, Dick Doobie, ended up as the head football coach. 3. The Morning Run. On the third floor of Doobie Hall was the room in which Dick Doobie had slept as a child. Now its battered oak door held 2 3-by-5 index cards neatly thumbtacked one atop the other. The top one said in Smith Corona Pica, "If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and, which is more, you'll be a man, my son." Rudyard Kipling, 1892. The other card read, "Rudyard Kipling was a 4:30 miler. Quentin Cassidy, 1969. Inside the room, the one true Quentin Cassidy slept fitfully as dawn approached. In a damp orb of his own worst fears, he nightmared with a certain grace. It was an old and familiar theme with him. The last lap of a foot race found him being soundly thrashed by every man on the track. He was running in peanut butter up to his waist as they all glided by easily. He tried to use his hands to grab something to propel himself along, but it was useless. What was wrong here? Was his training inadequate? Where was his kick? Mercifully, he awoke. Before the alarm, moist from his fretting, but forgetting the dream quickly. He sat on the edge of the bed, wiggling his toes thoughtfully as the cobwebs of anxiety slowly melted away in his shaggy head. In the waking world, his whole being centered around covering ground quickly on foot. At this, he really had no equals save a few dozen others scattered about the country and world who also woke to such disquieting dreams. Quentin Cassidy knew every one of them by name. Wearing only the weightless nylon shorts he slept in, he ambled stiffly to the dawn-lit window and stood, momentarily, drowsily enjoying the pale, orange-yellow glow that suffused the blackjack oaks outside his room. A slight breeze was chilly enough to raise goosebumps on sleep-warm flesh. He did not much like this early morning business, but the idea of foregoing it, even for one morning, never crossed his mind. Quentin Cassidy was 6'2", his meager 167 pounds stretched across his frame in the manner dictated by the searing daily necessities of his special task. Beneath the tight skin, a smooth musculature glided with fluid ease, giving the impression of elastic, lightweight power, a featherless view of a young falcon. There were no inefficient corners or bulges. The form was sharply chiseled as if from sand-worn driftwood, fluted with oblique angles and long, tapering ridges, thin products of his care. Even now, as he stood perfectly still in the early morning glow, inverted teardrop thighs and high-bunched calves suggested only motion, smooth, effortless speed. Stretching with a lovely kind of pain, he turned from the window and sat again on the edge of the rumpled bed to put on his worn Adidas Gazelle training shoes. His face was ruddy, even in the soft light, with a Scandinavian nose and sharp cheekbones. Its attractiveness was debatable. Ragged brownish hair, bleached by hours of sun, tumbled in no particular pattern as he double-knotted his shoes. He washed his hands in the sink. The shoelaces, repositories of ancient sweat, smelled like something that had died behind the refrigerator. And with a grunt, he was out the door and gone. Quentin Cassidy was a miler. Out in the early morning streets, the small group of runners made its way down University Avenue and turned north on 34th Street. They would traverse a large 7-mile square known interchangeably as the Morning Loop, the 7-mile course, or the Bacon Strip, for a series of undulating hills. Cassidy ran in the back of the pack with a loose stride that approached awkwardness. For a miler, the 6:30 pace was a stumble, but with his accumulated fatigue, he wanted nothing more challenging. He chatted quietly with Jerry Meisner, a thinner and darker runner who had the look of a true distance man. He and Cassidy had been through what they now called the Trial of Miles. As with shipwreck survivors, hostages, and others in dire circumstances, duress fosters an unsentimental kind of intimacy. At times, Cassidy and Meisner seemed to be able to read each other's minds.
"I don't think it can be done, really," Meisner said.
"It's absolutely true. I can sleep for at least the first half mile. I'm sure of it. They say soldiers can march when..."
"Nah."
"Well, it feels like I'm sleeping. That's good enough for me."
"Feeling and doing are different. Plato said that. Or Hugh Hefner. One of the philosophers, anyway."
For Cassidy, there was no joy at all in this morning routine. He slept hard and woke slowly. The morning people who claimed to like these dawn-lit forays really annoyed him. But the gentle conversation made it easier, a social occasion of sorts, for just as rank has its privileges, so indeed does the barely comprehensible conditioning of good distance runners. They gab like magpies. At paces that might stun and dismay the religious jogger, the runners easily kept up all manner of chatter and horseplay. When they occasionally blew by a huffing fatty or an aging roadrunner, they automatically toned down the banter to avoid overwhelming, to preclude the appearance of showboating, not that they slowed in the slightest. They, in fact, respected these distant cousins of the spirit, who, among all people, had some modicum of insight into their own milieu. But the runners resembled them only in the sense that a puma resembles a pussycat. It is the difference between stretching lazily on the carpet and prowling the jungle for fresh red meat.
"I suppose we'll soon know who's nice and rested from the weekend," Cassidy said. They were nearing the halfway point.
"Three guesses," said Meisner.
Despite the standing prohibition against racing during long runs, a practice that rapidly got out of hand, a young runner would occasionally light out for cheap glory.
"Get a load," Cassidy said, gesturing ahead.
Meisner looked up and gave Cassidy a grin and an "I'll be fugged" shrug.
"Monday morning scalders," Meisner said jauntily.
The reference was to Jack Nubbins, 20 yards ahead of the group and still pressing. A promising freshman from the scrub pine territory north of Orlando, he had been courted by a number of schools until his transcripts revealed some troubling deficiencies. When Nubbins arrived at Southeastern on probationary status, he proceeded to tell his other first-year colleagues at Doobie Hall,
"Nubbins is the name, and I cut the mile in 4:12.3, but I ride a horse better than that, and in the fall I hunt wild hog with my granddaddy, sometimes employing a weapon, sometimes not. Nice to meet you."
The other runners, albeit distance men and accustomed to a certain amount of weirdness, judged him loony as a gull and fascinating as all get out. Cassidy liked him okay, but thought he laughed too loud and got too much mileage out of idioms like hogtied and gut shot. Additionally, he appeared to lack a certain respect.
"I don't think he's going to be able to restrain himself this morning," Cassidy muttered irritably.
Some of the other runners were trying to pick up the pace to catch Nubbins, and the group was starting to string out. The unspoken rule against racing had a sanction. Those who persisted at it might well find themselves in a death match with an upperclassman.
"You did 27 yesterday, didn't you?" Cassidy said.
"Yep."
"You wouldn't want to come along anyway, would you, just for grins?"
"Nope."
"That's what I thought. See ya."
"See ya."
Nubbins had been a prodigy in high school. He had indeed run the mile in 4:12 and had very nearly broken 9 minutes for 2 miles. These were impressive accomplishments for a schoolboy athlete and gave Nubbins unarguable status among his young peers. A strong runner such as he, unfettered by a sense of unity and left unrestrained, would simply destroy most of his teammates. Soon he would represent to them the pinnacle, the ultimate competitor. He would forever be the ceiling of their accomplishment. If his were a certain kind of personality, he would accept this responsibility with love and great modesty. As long as he was undisputedly their vanquisher, he would laugh and joke with them and pound their backs in ribald camaraderie. Then daily on the trails or roads or track, he would casually stomp them into submission. Meisner called it the top dog syndrome. Everyone was competitive with his fellows to a certain extent. Being bested in a daily workout by one's teammates did not portend well for the time when one went out to take on the rest of the world. But Cassidy was trying to bring the younger runners along without resorting to humbling daily comparisons. He was stronger than they were. He wanted them to know it, but not to dwell on it. There is time, he would tell them, time and time and time. He wanted to impart some of the truths Bruce Denton had taught him, that you don't become a champion by winning a morning workout. The only true way is to marshal the ferocity of your ambition over the course of many days, weeks, months, and, if you could finally come to accept it, years. The trial of miles. Miles of trials. How could he make them understand? Nubbins was nowhere near a slouch. He was fast and courageous and mentally tough, and he had 9 state high school titles to prove it. Like all good runners, he gave away nothing. Cassidy knew he had long taken winning for granted, that he was accustomed to looking over at an opponent with a kind of detached pity and then surging off with great style. The gradual sense of despair Nubbins now felt was a new and discomforting experience. He had never run with a non-negotiable shadow before. He picked it up just a tad more, but Quentin Cassidy, his T-shirt read, "Gaunt is beautiful," just looked over and smiled back pleasantly. "You feeling pretty good, Jack?" Cassidy asked on the exhale. "Not too bad, I reckon," Nubbins tried to grin. "Good," Cassidy said as he kicked the pace down about 10 seconds a mile. A minute later, just as Nubbins was almost accustomed to the now alarming pace, Cassidy threw in a 32-second 2:20. They were now all but sprinting along the early morning sidewalk. Nubbins's face was both tight and pale. His expression said that he was a man with a problem. They flew along at sub-5-minute pace, quite fast enough to startle pedestrians. They blew into the last mile, came upon and passed on either side of a sleepy co-ed bound for first period class. Reams of biology notes filled the air. Meisner trotted up to the front porch steps of Doobie Hall, where Cassidy sagged in repose.
"Well," he said, "is he a believer yet?"
"Hell if I know. Geez, he's a tough little bastard. Next time you take him. Did you see him back there anywhere?"
"Yeah, passed him half a mile back. Said he was turning off to go lift weights at the field house. That what he told you?"
"No. All he said to me was, 'Ack.'"
"Ack?"
"Ack."
And then he bent over and grabbed his knees and commenced serious air sucking.
In the world of the runner, as in the ocean, there is a hierarchy of ferocity. In the sea, the swift blue runner is eaten by the slashing barracuda, which is eaten by the awesome mako shark. In track, such relative positions are fixed more or less in black and white and are altered only at great and telling expense. Pride necessarily sprouts and grows, a pride that can only come from relentless kneading of unwilling flesh, painful months of grinding and burning away all that is heavy, all that is strength-sapping and useless to the body as a projectile. The runner becomes almost haughty. He looks to those stronger with respect and fear, to those slower with sympathy or tolerance. They tread ground he has long since covered. The jettisoning of but a single second is announced like a birth in the family. Quentin Cassidy had run 1 mile in 4:03. And despite the near indifference of the sporting world, 4-minute milers are still very nearly as rare a breed as, say, astronauts. The name Cassidy appeared in the school record books 8 separate times, counting the various relays. Though Jack Nubbins was a talented young runner, Quentin Cassidy had viewed the specter. When he reached down through the familiar layers of gloom and fatigue, he generally found more there than a nameless and transient desire to acquire plastic trophies. He and Nubbins were not even in the same ballpark.
"Good morning, Captain Cassidy," called Michael Mobley, the All-American shot putter. He surrounded his table as if it were a toy.
"Good morning, Captain Mobley," Cassidy called back. "Join you in just a moment."
Cassidy had probably started this exaggerated politeness among the tri-captains. He had a helpless affinity for harmless traditions. The dining room at Doobie Hall was suggestive of what might happen if a cargo plane full of raw sirloin were to crash in Lion Country Safari. Several dozen athletes screamed, laughed, cajoled, and punched one another in the easy, fond intimacy that sports gives to young men in groups and that they would consciously or subconsciously miss for the rest of their lives. The good-humored pandemonium was considerable as they consumed caloric numbers more befitting a small town. The relatively thin distance runners ate more than you would expect. Cassidy loaded his tray with 3 scrambled eggs, 2 pancakes, sausage, nearly a quart of milk, and 2 donuts for later. A colossus like Mobley, however, simply ate with a vengeance. With unswerving deliberation and concentration, he sat and consumed.
"Gotta keep up my strength, right?" he would say. "Otherwise, you gotta go to anabolic steroids, and I don't want my nuts to shrivel up like peanuts, right?"
He laughed like a bass drum. The weight men were cocky, masculine, and actually fairly gentle. They never needed to bully, such was their looming physical presence. These specimens made their particular way in the world by heaving 16-pound iron balls great distances, tossing fiberglass plates out of vision, whipping sharpened aluminum shafts to the horizon. They were the most direct throwbacks to ancient times when such arts were cultivated to bash and puncture the armor of one's enemies, to spill blood from a distance. They were the heavy artillery of old. The confidence of those who do such things well is enormous and needs no bravado for support. They feared only one another. The distance runners were serene messengers. Gliding along wooded trails and mountain paths, their spiritual ancestors kept their own solitary counsel for long hours while carrying some message, the import of which was only one corner of their considerable speculation. They lived within themselves. Long ago they did so, and they do today. There was great unspoken respect between the weight men and the distance runners that was understood but never examined closely. They all dealt in one way or another with the absolute limits of the human body and spirit. But the runners and weight men seemed to somehow share a special understanding, and there were good friendships among them. The sprinters and jumpers were quite another story. Their art revolved around a single explosive instant during which all was gained or lost. They were, perhaps, the spiritual descendants of the assault troops who leaped trenches and scaled barricades to lead the attack. They were nervous, high-strung, either giddy with success or mired in swamp funk. They were the manic depressives of the track world. They constantly puffed themselves up with braggadocio, either to bolster their own flagging courage or to intimidate their opponents. The intensity of their competition was ferocious, almost cruel. A high jumper is in the air less than a second and a half. A sprinter's race takes 10 seconds. A pole vaulter stands with fiberglass catapult in hand and contemplates his task far longer than the 3 seconds he struggles in the aspic of space. Cassidy pitied them the intensity of their contests, but at the same time was envious. One would grunt with the enormous effort, elastic muscles responding from years of weight training and explosive exercise, soaring up, up, and turning on an axis of perfect technique so quick you would miss the beauty of it if you did not know what to look for. An awful moment of hate-filled glaring at the dreaded black-and-white bar, a fragile, shame-bearing obstruction, loathsome to the touch. And then, a free fall, throwing your fist with joy and relief back to earthly cares. Yes, there was something to that, Cassidy would think, particularly on a hot spring day when he had to run 15 or 20 quarter miles on a sticky track shimmering with heat. In any event, Cassidy's table companions made for lively dining. He and Meisner, still damp from the shower, finished filling their trays and sat down across from Mobley, who gave the impression of eating with both hands.
"Heard you guys were scalding dogs this morning," Mobley said without halting the intake.
Now, just why the details of a morning run would be of interest to a member of the Guerrilla Corps is certainly beyond me, said Meisner, who well knew that Mobley reacted to no brash comments. The giant, all 6'6", 265 pounds of him, scarcely stopped chewing. He looked up with an expression that was something less than annoyance.
"Just be sure to keep those little dweebs in line, please, Captain," he told Cassidy, shoveling in half a pancake. He gulped. "We've got a chance to win some big brass at conference this year, and your pond birds are going to have to get their points."
"Pond birds, is it?" said Meisner, pounding his spoon like an impatient child. "Pond birds? I have a good mind to pump up for a couple of months and take your young ass on." The imagery evoked by such a notion caused considerable merriment around the room. 4. Cross Country. Cassidy's year, a runner's year, was divided into three parts. Fall was cross country, a season of 6-mile races that stretched from the heat of Florida's long Indian summer to the frozen slush of November in the north and west. Winter was the indoor season, a time of exciting races on the little banked wooden tracks in the large cities of the northeast. Spring and early summer were for what Denton called real track. During the bleak expanse of fall and winter, however, real track was too far off to think about. Cassidy did not like cross-country. The distance was too long for a miler. He disliked not being able to feel the finish line during the race. 6 miles seemed interminable to a runner accustomed to the blissful, unyielding symmetry of 4 quarter miles run in nearly 60 seconds each. He never felt the first lap. The second and third were pure hell, but over quickly, and the last went by in the giddy excitement of the sprint and the locked-up zombie gait of total oxygen debt.
"What's wrong with cross-country?" Denton asked.
Warm-down time was slow luxury, an easy mile of deep, aching satisfaction. "Some weird people like it, I know that. I'm very aware of that," Cassidy said. A muted glance passed between Denton and Meisner. They had heard this before. 6 miles, 10,000 meters, Cassidy said disgustedly, over hill and dale, out in the middle of nowhere, spit freezing on your goddamn chin. 500 complete wild men in the mud, running up on your heels with long spikes. Oh, I love cross-country, all right. I also like being flayed alive with a rusty straight razor."
"Why, Quentin, you were county champion in high school. I saw it in your scrapbook. You had a clipping from the morning paper and a clipping from the evening paper. Don't you remember?" Denton asked seriously. Meisner bit his lip.
"Sticking my tongue in a light socket, that's a lot of fun, too," Cassidy said moodily.
"But you did win the..."
"Yes, and for your information, it was my mother who cut out those clippings. You can tell by how neatly they are trimmed. I don't operate that way."
"Quentin Cassidy, cross-country champion."
"It was a 2.5-mile race, and the competition was fierce, lads. Several local entries could have been real trouble if the race had only been 2.25 miles shorter. They were the kind of guys who yell and scream for the first 100 yards, you know, like they are having a good time and all."
"But they couldn't hold the pace, huh?"
"It kills me when they yell and scream like that,
or talk back and forth to each other real nonchalant like it's not bothering them at all?
Cassidy looked genuinely puzzled.
But tough cookies nonetheless?
Denton wouldn't let him off the hook.
To a man.
Cassidy grinned at Meisner.
I leaned at the tape and nipped second place by about half a mile.
Maybe they sent the wrestling team by accident.
Anyway, Palm Beach County is not noted for its cross-country strength.
Half a mile is what Mize usually gets you by, isn't it?
Cassidy feigned hurt.
You don't need to rub it in. I told you I don't like it. You distance animals can have it.
Milers are too fine-tuned to enjoy that pastoral crap.
So are roadrunners, racewalkers, orienteering nuts, and a bunch of other folks looking to avoid real confrontation, Denton said.
Right, Meisner said. He liked watching Cassidy having to take it for a while. Real confrontation is four laps and a cloud of tartan dust, Cassidy said.
That's clever.
Tartan dust? Meisner asked.
Oh, yes, that's really clever.
Denton shook his head.
You guys can just blow it out your...
Steady, big fellow,
Denton said in his mock deep voice, the Lone Ranger calming Old Silver down after a hard day of chasing desperados. Cassidy laughed and threw a half-hearted elbow at Denton, who dodged and rolled his eyes. Coach Benjamin Cornwall was getting into his car when he saw the three of them jostling one another at the door of the field house. Weary from his own work, he never could figure out what it was about a 20-mile day that made some people so playful.
Three more? Cassidy asked. At least.
He and Meisner did 100-yard striders in the grass, trying to build up some lactic acid resistance and get the systems moving. They wanted to be well into what some people call the second wind before the race started. The runners usually referred to it by the psychologist's term, homeostasis. Whatever it is called, it entails a good, hard warm-up. They had already run 3 miles at an easy pace. Dual meets were not at all hectic, and Cassidy didn't really mind this miniature version of cross-country. A single team would not usually have enough talent to present much of a challenge, even to Cassidy. Neither he nor Meisner considered this particular Saturday important enough to slack off their training in the slightest. They had both run 16 miles the day before, a gambit known as running through a meet. When you are beaten by an athlete running through, it means you are owned by him body and soul. The fixed order will have been established in a most definitive way, to be altered only by some kind of felonious conduct, possibly involving anti-personnel mines. Bruce Denton ran up from behind them and fell in with their strides. Even at this quick pace, his legs moved with a ghostly lack of effort. Runners from the other team stole glances at him. Cassidy thought, "The little sons of bitches are experiencing awe."
"You doing your morning?" Meisner asked.
"Yep. Thought I'd come over and watch the fun."
"I hate racing in the morning like this," Cassidy offered.
"There's not a whole lot about this deal you do like, is there, sport?"
Denton smiled at him.
"Not much, I guess," Cassidy admitted gloomily. "My gut goes crazy."
"Do these guys have any horses?" Denton asked.
"The red-headed fellow," said Meisner, gesturing. "The one so very obviously not looking at us. That's Eamon O'Rourke, a genuine imported Irishman. Guess they couldn't afford themselves an African."
Meisner was unconsciously mimicking Cassidy.
"Gave you a scare last year indoors, didn't he, sport?"
Denton turned to Cassidy.
"Scare isn't the word. It was the Mason-Dixon games in Louisville. The score was the kid 403.2, the Irish upstart 403.2. But it was closer than it sounds."
Denton laughed as they started another strider. O'Rourke's freckled face was clouded with concentration as he did his own warm-up. He glanced constantly at his watch, timing it to the minute. They had about 8 minutes before assembling for the starting instructions. O'Rourke was older than the rest of his team, older and far more mature.
His talent and courage had delivered him from the rigors of life in Northern Ireland, and he went at distance running with the uncomplicated ardor of the truly hungry. Denton appraised the Irishman's stride as he went by and thought, "There is always something behind it, isn't there, fella? With us and prize fighters, the wounded and the fleet." O'Rourke was thinking about Cassidy's cloth-thin victory the previous season. It still rankled him. The American was all right, he supposed, just too blithe a spirit to suit O'Rourke. A few weeks after the Louisville meet, O'Rourke had picked up an intestinal flu and was all but incapacitated during much of the outdoor season. It had been a bad December. A telegram hanging in a serious-looking plastic envelope on his dormitory room door brought the bad news from home. He had sat quietly for 5 minutes looking at the sad little yellow message. Then he pulled on his training shoes and went out to run himself into a blubbering mush in the hills surrounding his Tennessee campus. Then he was in bed for 2 weeks and really wouldn't have minded dying. "Cold Decembers," he thought, watching the carefree American. "I have known too many of them." They were less than a half mile from the finish. Cassidy ran slightly behind O'Rourke off his left shoulder, eyes fixed on the freckled neck. He was drafting without malice or humor. If O'Rourke minded being used in this manner, he gave no sign. Somewhere up ahead, Jerry Meisner was sauntering into the finish chute with the more tolerable fatigue of victory on his face. He had employed the simple expedient of running away from everyone. Similarly isolated from the rest of the runners, the two-milers bruised each other in the tensionless grind of those who struggle for second place. Cassidy was in extremis. They had gone through the first mile in 4:37, and Cassidy thought with alarm, "God almighty, that hurt!" The heavy training of the past several weeks had sapped him. When he reached down for an extra surge just to hold pace, he found only a searing, strained feeling with which he was intimately familiar. Red Line City. He was not enjoying his weekend. Hanging on to O'Rourke these past 2 miles had been possible through a dreary combination of willpower and wishful thinking. "Coast, you bastard," Cassidy told himself. Then he put his mind into neutral, locked onto the freckled shoulder, and obtained his mental abstracts. Gliding, floating, covering ground. He balked unashamedly at the remarkable discomfort he was living through at the moment. He even thought of tossing it in, not an unusual sentiment, but he knew it wouldn't happen. He also kept telling himself that they wouldn't all be this bad, because if they were, he surely couldn't live with it. He didn't consider himself particularly courageous. A long path led up the hill through Beta Woods and onto the track for the finish. The hill was steep. It numbed the legs and discouraged fast finishes. O'Rourke intentionally worked Cassidy hard on this hill, surgically removing the sting from a kick he remembered quite clearly. Pumping hard, he pulled away. With great distress, Cassidy reeled him back in. "This isn't so bad," Cassidy thought. "I'm just dying is all. But hang on, asshole, and maybe you can be a hero at the end." The self-loathing was genuine, and when he thought about it later, it always mystified him. Every stride now caused him the most profound regret. Spitting fluffy wads of congealed saliva, his thinking soon came only in staccato bursts. 200 yards. Keep him near. Keep him near. Within sight of the finish, he could vaguely see Meisner doing a silly bounce and yelling something as Cassidy began to lock up. Andrea would be there somewhere, but he didn't see her. A white haze, a normal phenomenon, clouded everything, like looking through the dirty window of a long-abandoned house. Funny how your mind works at the end like this, he thought. The excitement was all outside as he watched quietly from inside his raging skull. 100 yards to go. He thought, "Oh, Christ," and threw the remainder of what was left into it. Now that really cost him. O'Rourke burst away from him quickly and won by 10 yards. Cassidy was bent over at the waist, hands on knees, doing a little circle stagger that, in other circumstances, might have passed for amusing. The other runners were noisily starting to come in. Meisner stood with his arm around Cassidy's waist, providing balance.
"Easy, easy," he said in calm, empathetic tones. Cassidy could not speak. His eyes bulged insanely, breaths came in greedy rasps, and his face was a splotchy violet color.
"Yuck,"
he said, trying to straighten up. It was too soon. Dizziness forced him back to the hands-on-knees death grip, the fetal rest position of the totally done-in runner. The white haze had thickened into a heavy fog. He felt faint, but knew his conditioning would protect him from everything but extreme heat. These were the worst few seconds, and he understood better than anything else that, like the tail fin, the Nehru jacket, and the Republic itself, they too would pass. The drained elation, special property and reward of those who have been to the edge and back, would come later. But for now, he had a while longer to hurt. Andrea, who had never seen such things, stood close by, almost afraid to touch him, hands fluttering around each other and over to his wet singlet. The rasping, dripping, violet-shaded runner studied the moist earth between his spiked toes and seemed unaware of her presence. Was he all right?
"Sure, hell, he's all right," Meisner said, surprised by her question. "He's just run himself a race, is all."
Seeing that Cassidy had his own balance, Meisner went off gaily to check the team scores. Finally straightening up enough to stumble for a few steps, the runner looked at her and said again,
"Yak!"
But this time there was something that could have passed for a smile on his hot face. To her, he looked near death, not a mysterious wan passing, but a demise culminating in hot bouts of fever and hallucination, fearful and soul-wrenching. The smile brought her considerable cheer.
"Yak?"
she smiled back.
"Gee, that was uncomfortable," he said seriously as he began to make himself walk.
He was unaccustomed to long spikes. One caught, he stumbled as he gripped her hand.
"What did you think?"
"I thought you were going to die there for a second. I was afraid."
"Well," he said jovially, "that's the cross-country biz."
Denton stood 20 yards away, chatting with the coaches, but his eyes followed Quentin Cassidy closely. Half an hour later, he gathered up Meisner and Cassidy, and the three of them trotted off laughing on the 8-mile course to get in some miles for the day. 5. Bowling for Dollars. Jerry Meisner was an admitted obsessive-compulsive, probably a necessity for a true distance man. His mind adapted well to the distance runner's daily toil. Cassidy was far more impulsive by nature and had to painfully teach himself the record-keeping, ritualistic, never-miss-a-mile mentality of a dedicated runner. Meisner and Denton, like Jim Ryan or Jerry Lindgren, were natural runners who had never even attempted other sports seriously. Cassidy had good speed, and like Peter Snell, had done well in other sports before concentrating on middle distances. At times, he felt like a spiritual interloper with the other two. Occasionally, he was actually jealous of the way they casually handled the workload. Slowly, for survival's sake, he learned the lifestyle of the compulsive personality. But when he occasionally wavered, Meisner felt sorry for him and tried to help him through the bouts of blue funk and strange behavior. Cassidy would say,
"The kid is largely unhappy."
"There, there. Got caught in the rain and my green stamps got all plastered to my sweet-and-low."
"It'll be okay.
Bet my money on the bobtail nag."
The friction caused by superimposing alien psychological traits on his own personality occasionally burst forth in interesting manifestations. Cassidy arranging a quadruple moonshot, the famous four-way pressed ham, out of the tailgate of a duly licensed state vehicle. Cassidy presenting a series of unauthorized awards at the cross-country banquet in mixed company. "And now a very special presentation, the Zazu Pitts Memorial Plaque, to the runner who most infrequently committed flatus on the morning run." Cassidy, as Nubbins put it one night in bewilderment, "just plain walking around talking funny."
Whatever outward form his inner disquietudes took, his odd energies held Doobie Hall like a spell. In this tiny society where the extreme was commonplace, Cassidy's mystique affected everyone. He was often sought out for counsel, and his apparent reluctance to render it only added to his aura. His opinion was solicited on matters scholastic, financial, romantic, and mechanical, though he disavowed expertise in all these areas. He had the gifted athlete's innate sense of timing, a sense of providence, of fantasy, an intuition into the art of the proper moment, where the escape velocity of frivolous lunacy triumphs over the mean gravity of everyday life. By way of example, the doldrums of summer were approaching at the end of his junior year when Cassidy, bored with the hot, ennui-stilled Sunday lunch, posed a general question to the drowsy dining room. "I wonder if Spider can jump over a Volkswagen." Spider Gordon looked up sleepily from his vegetable soup.
"Of course he can jump over a Volkswagen," said the giant Mobley, his mouth full as usual. "You ought to know that."
"Yes, yes, of course he can. Spider can easily jump over a Volkswagen," Cassidy said. Mumbling, everyone turned back to the unexciting lunch, clearly disappointed. What had gotten into Cassidy? "The real question," Cassidy continued after a proper pause, "the real question here is whether Spider can jump over two Volkswagens." The philosophical extensions of this problem became quickly evident, and the dining room emptied like a barroom shooting. The neighborhood was scoured for a certain make of foreign car, and the entire affair went down in Doobie Hall folklore as the day Spider Gordon busted his ass on the fourth Volkswagen. New members of the team, freshmen or transfer students, were given no special warning about Cassidy. They found out, as everyone else did, in the best way they could. "Gentlemen," Cassidy would say, rising at dinner and tapping his glass for silence, "we have